A violent Maoist rebellion, also known as the Naxalite insurgency, has spread to 20 of India's provinces. The group has burnt schools, killed more than 900 security officers, and in at least one province, detonated more than 1,000 improvised explosive devices over the past 5 years. The situation has gotten so bad that the Indian government is now preparing to send thousands of soldiers into the Maoist strongholds, which also happen to be some of the most impoverished and economically undeveloped parts of India. On today's underreported segment, we will speak with Brad Adams, Executive Director of Human Rights Watch's Asia Division. He's currently in India, and I'm very pleased to welcome him back to our show. Hi.
Hi, Lennon. How are you?
I'm okay. This week has been marked by numerous celebrations surrounding the fall of communism 20 years ago, but this group in India describes itself as Maoist. Are they communist rebels in the same way that we would have thought of communist insurgents 20, 30, or 40 years ago?
At the leadership level, they probably have a lot of the same ideology. This is a movement that has its roots in the old communist era. But at the foot soldier level, I don't think there's a whole lot of ideology. I think there's just a reaction to poverty, lack of development. You know, in watching India at the front table of international economic powers now, and all the wealth that's in places like Mumbai and Delhi, the nice cars, the big houses, people really flaunting their wealth in this country, while people in this region basically live in grass huts, have no schools, no roads, no infrastructure. The government has hardly even penetrated the area.
So if we're looking at a map, if we were looking at a map of India, what parts of the country would we find these insurgents in?
It's really the heart of India, straight down the center of the country, slightly more east than west. The west of the country is more prosperous than the east. Chhattisgarh State is the epicenter of this. It runs into Orissa State, Andhra Pradesh. It encompasses parts of 20 states, but really it's mainly located in the central six states of India.
Does the fact that Chhattisgarh is a young state make it more vulnerable?
No, Chhattisgarh was hived off from another state, Andhra Pradesh, Madhya Pradesh, a long time ago. It's not more vulnerable because of that, except for the fact that the state police force has been tasked to deal with the insurgency, and they are very poorly equipped, but so are the neighboring states. The police are not equipped to deal with an insurgency of this type, and in fact, many, many police officers have been ambushed and killed, and some have even been beheaded. The problem is that when the Indian government comes in with heavier weapons and more highly trained troops, either army officers or paramilitaries, they really have employed a scorched earth policy in the past. And now with the government saying they're going to send in as many as 17,000 new troops, there's every reason to be concerned about how they'll conduct themselves.
Do you see any link between the increased Maoist activity and the decline of the communist parties all over India, especially in the past 5 years?
I don't think so. I mean, this is a very localized problem. The Communist Party, for instance, has held on to power in West Bengal, you know, where Calcutta is, for a very long time. I think this is more about the disconnect between these parts of India and the rest of India. You know, a few years ago, the government was talking about India shining as its slogan. And I was just attending the World Economic Forum's meeting here in India, and they were going on about 9% growth rate as their target instead of the 6.5% they have. But nobody in government was talking about how any of that would benefit the poor. And remember, in India, there are hundreds of millions of very poor people still. Even though parts of the economy are taking off, a very large number of people here are being left behind.
Are there no plans to build up more of an economic base in these areas, a way of countering these groups?
Well, the government has been talking about doing that for decades, and I think this is part of the reason for so many people in these areas being willing to follow the Maoists, because they really feel like they've gotten nothing from the government. They don't believe government promises. This government, you know, has renewed these commitments, but there's a real question about whether it has the capacity or the will to do real development in these areas. I mean, these are places, many of these villages have no schools, there's no health clinics, the roads don't really work. So, you know, imagine you're a pregnant woman and you're having some complications as you approach giving birth. You wouldn't have a place to go. If you wanted to get there, you wouldn't have a road to take you. You wouldn't have a vehicle to take you. And that's why, you know, India, for example, has one-third of the maternal deaths in the world still. It's really a country of increasingly two economic poles. And there's a real backlash going on in the heartland of the country.
So how many people are we talking about involved in this insurrection? Do we know?
No. I mean, the Naxalites are extremely secretive, and this is very characteristic of Maoist parties. It's very hard to tell, and you know, one of the reasons is that the government hasn't penetrated many of the areas where they operate. There are whole districts, and you know, large numbers of them, that the Maoists actually control, where they're essentially running the government in those areas. Imagine you're a police officer in one of these places with a vintage rifle from, say, the 1950s. You're not going to have a lot of incentive to go looking for Naxals and moving into their territory. Same is true of civil servants. And so in many parts of the country, there just isn't much of a government presence, and therefore it's not really clear how many people are with the Naxals.
Where does the name Naxalite come from?
It comes from a place in West Bengal where a revolt occurred in the late 1960s, a place called Naxalbari, and the name of the Naxalites has come from the location of that. The Naxalites now want to call themselves Maoists, which I think is revealing. It has partly to do with ideology and partly with the fact that the Maoist party in Nepal essentially succeeded in a civil war. There was a very bloody 10-year civil war in Nepal, and the Maoists forced the king from power, forced national elections, and then they got the most votes in the election.
In talking about that insurrection some years ago, the person we spoke with said that he thought that they were more like Shining Path than they were like any Chinese Maoists.
Well, the Shining Path really had a scorched earth policy. I mean, if you go back and look at the number of people they killed, it was, you know, very high. And this group does seem to have more political goals, so I wouldn't really compare them to the Shining Path. I think they don't know what they can do. I mean, they've now indicated in comments given to the press just today that they might consider negotiations with the government, although they refuse to lay down their arms. And it may be that the model in Nepal is something they're looking at, where they're trying to negotiate their way into power. National power is out of the question for them, but whether they might be able to negotiate some kind of power deals in the areas where they have strongholds, I think may be something they're looking at.
I'm talking with Brad Adams of Human Rights Watch about the Maoist insurgency in India, an insurgency that Prime Minister Manmohan Singh now describes as the single greatest threat to India's internal security. Now, Prime Minister Singh is also an economist and viewed as one of the main architects of India's economic boom. But you say that he hasn't paid much attention to improving the lives of the people involved in this insurgency?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know whether his intentions are good or not, or whether it's been the failure of the bureaucracy and the government to deliver on his good intentions. But the fact is that the poor are getting relatively, and in many parts of the country, absolutely poorer as India's economic boom happens. You know, there is a massive amount of economic activity at the corporate level, and private investment is flowing into the country in many parts of the country. But in the center of India, there is no investment. The only investment there is of large corporations who are trying to extract minerals from the area. This is the place in India that has the largest deposits of bauxite. Some say it's the largest deposits of bauxite in the world, which is used to make aluminum, iron ore, manganese, and other precious metals. And the sense of people in the area is that corporations are trying to take their land, dispossess them, and extract their mineral wealth while leaving very little behind. And the problem is that there's really no basis right now for these companies and the government on one side and the Naxalites to talk. There's complete lack of trust on both sides.
India has a federalist system. Has that complicated matters in terms of development and in fighting the insurgents?
I am sure it has. I met with a minister last month when I was here who told me that he has no power to implement his policies because the states often just resist the national policies. And so he has a very large budget for rural development, but he says that it really will be up to the different states to determine how they spend the money. And one of the things that Indians complain about is the very high level of corruption here. And the minister sort of laughed when I suggested that corruption was a problem. He said, yeah, I mean, everybody knows that. A lot of the money never makes it to its intended recipients.
In an interview last month, one of the movement's leaders, Mupala Laxman Rao, also known as Ganapathy, threatened to unleash a tornado of violence if the government launches a major offensive against his group. I mentioned at the beginning of the segment that in one province, the rebels have detonated over 1,000 IEDs over the past 5 years. So should we assume that they're borrowing tactics used by insurgents in Iraq and Afghanistan against U.S. forces?
It's possible, although they've been using improvised explosives for a long time because they have such little access to weaponry. I mean, most of the weapons they get off of dead police officers and security forces. I think that they really don't appear to have much connection to the outside world, so I wouldn't press that concept too far. But it is a very effective tactic to set off roadside bombs. It really, you know, terrifies the very poorly armed and trained security forces who are sent into this area.
And if recent history is any guide, launching a successful counterinsurgency is incredibly difficult. How has the Indian military been handling this? And how does Human Rights Watch see things? Has the military been accused of any human rights violations in fighting the insurgents?
Yeah, we published a 180-page report last summer of 2008, about this, and we documented large numbers of extrajudicial killings by the Indian security forces, torture, in some cases employing children as security forces, major displacement. I mean, one of the problems is that the Indian security forces aren't trained well enough to avoid abuses and excesses, and so in some cases, going after a few people, they've displaced whole villages. And it's led to a cycle of violence here that really has polarized things. It's not unlike what's happened in Kashmir over the years, where the Indian army has been very abusive in chasing after the militants who've been setting off bombs there. And really, we titled our report Being Neutral is Our Biggest Crime, because local villagers are between a rock and a hard place. At night, the Naxals come in and they demand shelter and food. Next morning, the army comes in and accuses people of providing shelter and food, and they get it from both sides.
We have a link, by the way, to your report on our show page at WNYC.org.
Great.
Kobad Gandhi, the highest-ranking Naxalite member to be taken alive by the Indian government, was captured in September. And just last week, a Delhi court gave the authorities permission to inject him with barbiturate sodium pentothal, or truth serum. Is that a common practice in India? Hasn't that been proven to not really work?
Yeah, it's not a common practice, but it does happen here from time to time. The same thing was tried on the surviving terrorist in the Mumbai attacks last year. The odd thing about it is that evidence obtained from this is not admissible in court because it's inherently unreliable. So I am puzzled by why this judge agreed to this. It sounded almost like a publicity stunt. Maybe they think they'll be able to get some usable intelligence, but they certainly won't be able to use it to prosecute him. And it actually gives the Indian justice system a bad image. I think it's a pretty bad idea that they did this.
Who are the Salwa Judum, and what role are they playing in this story?
The Salwa Judum are a vigilante force that was created in Chhattisgarh province because some of the residents of Chhattisgarh wanted to take force into their own hands because they thought the state wasn't doing a good enough job fighting the Naxalites. And it is understandable. I don't think anyone should romanticize the Naxalites. You know, I've described their grievances as being real, and I think the sympathy should be for people living in these areas that are deprived. But the Naxalites are using, you know, really horrible tactics. There have been beheadings and innumerable killings. And so, you know, some local people, you know, felt like they had to do something, but it quickly spun out of control. I mean, you think about as if consider the Minutemen who went down to the Mexican border and imagine that they actually decided to start shooting people coming across the border as their enemy. And you can imagine how quickly that would get out of control. And the Salwa-Judum are, according to the national government, not going to be employed in the future, but the state government hasn't been so clear. And they really should be disbanded because they are untrained, undisciplined, and unaccountable.
We read a lot in our papers about the Taliban in Afghanistan and Pakistan. We read about the Tamil Tigers in Sri Lanka. But we're talking about India, the country with the second largest population in the world, and we hear very little about the Naxalites. Why do you think that is?
Well, you know, even Indians hear very little about the Naxalites until very recently. India has been caught up in its opening to the world. It's only recently become integrated in the international economic system. It's only recently had very large economic growth rates. It's only recently started, you know, becoming members of international fora like the G20. And there's a lot of razzle-dazzle, I would say, about India being an emerging economic superpower. I've always found that puzzling. You know, this is a country where some of the poorest people in the world live, and where in, you know, the UN development rankings, India is extremely low, and it has.
And Brad, we have to end it there, unfortunately. But I thank you so much for participating in our show, our underreported Brad Adams, Executive Director of Human Rights Watch's Asia Division. On tomorrow's show, New Yorker writer John Cassidy on the logic of economic calamities, and then Rana Husseini looks at honor killings around the world. Also, we will delve into the joys of Southern Italian cooking with Arthur Schwartz, and Please Explain is all about eco-labels and greenwashing. The Let It Lopate Show is produced by Stephen Valentino, Julia Corcoran, and Blakeney Schick. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Stephanie Bernhard, Fran Jacobs, and contributing producer Virginia Doris. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Let It Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. We will see you tomorrow.